Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. I'm Phil Carroll.
And I'm Kevin Horn.
Sunday the 17th of September, a lovely week we've just had, maybe the last real one of summer in the UK. How's your week in the US been, Kev? Is it the weather good over there, still on the East Coast?
Yeah, it's good, as in it's hot, but we've had lots and lots of torrential downpours in the afternoon, which is pretty commonplace, I think, in September here. So we haven't managed to get caught in one yet from being in the car. But yeah, it rains cats and dogs here. It doesn't rain raindrops. You know, it's like,
yeah.
And then you get the electric storm that's always with it. So yeah. But we were on the beach yesterday. The weather was gorgeous. Thought we were only there for maybe 1 or 2 hours, and then we had to head back to Savannah in Georgia. And we were actually at a place called Hilton Head yesterday, which I think any golf fans will know. There's a big PGA Tour event at Hilton Head, and I think they've done many major events there, so it's actually quite a nice place. Yeah. So yeah, and we're heading to Florida next week, so yeah.
Oh, you will be digging out then. Well, I've still got one of my summer shirts on, and I've got an iced coffee here, which is probably the last one I'll be having this year because the weather really does change. It's sort of more, let's say, in line with September temperatures down to sort of like mid-teens next week, but certainly been in the 20s this week, so all very good. But on to the news. I mean, there's been some pretty devastating news this week from Morocco. We saw the Moroccan earthquake. I mean, when they hit over there in places, we saw one in Turkey, didn't we, at the beginning of the year. I mean, when you see them hit, they hit really hard, don't they, with the houses generally, obviously quite a lot of them made out of clay. And there's not a lot of movement in that, is there? When it goes, it comes down like a pack of cards, unfortunately, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, structurally, these buildings are not built for any movement. So once things start to shake, it's a bit of a nightmare. So, yeah, it's been horrendous. Yeah, absolutely yeah. Horrendous. Hundreds, if not thousands, have died, I think. They haven't really got the full toll of it yet, but yeah, not good.
And then there was the terrible flooding in Libya, which, you know, basically, I don't know if you saw that, but it was certainly, there's questions around the integrity of the dams in the coastal city of Derna, you know, country plagued by civil war. After Gaddafi was assassinated many years ago, it's a shocking blow to the Libyans. But I don't know if you saw it, but it was frightening. It was what could only be described as a tidal wave or a tsunami of water flooding down the valley into this, and mentioned this coastal city of Derna. And it just literally devastated about a quarter of the city's population. It's like, I've never seen anything quite like it. There's people, you know, in houses just buried under these deluge of water. Many of the old mosques wiped out that have been around for thousands of years. So all the history has been wiped out. But it just beggars belief. And that, obviously, as I say, a lot of them they want the heads of the local, you know, the council, saying that, you know, this lack of infrastructure, lack of investment, and, you know, these were creaking dams. I don't know if you saw that over there.
No, I didn't really see it, but I'm just looking at the map in terms of exactly where it was. And it's not a million miles from where I was with Callum and Martha Matru. You know, yeah. It's maybe 300-500 kilometers along the coast. But yeah, it's not good at all.
And 10,000 so far, and they reckon it could go up to 20,000 people.
Yeah, I have 11,314 hours ago in Derna is the death toll. So that's just unbelievable, isn't it, really, when you think about it? And anywhere else in the world, or certainly in the Western world, and that would be...
Yeah.
Like, it'd be on every news channel, every minute of every day.
Yeah.
So it really is this horrific catastrophe, isn't it? Yeah. Horrendous.
So we've also had Kim Jong-un visit Putin in Russia. I don't know if you saw this, but he's basically visited in his heavily armored train with his entourage, and they travel many hundred miles. Obviously, they can go effectively across the border, can't they, through Siberia, at a very slow pace due to the weight of the thing. And it, you know, this thing is from a structural point of view, will withstand, you know, missile attacks, grenade attacks from underneath. So you can imagine how, I think it only maintains a pace of like 37 miles an hour. So it could take sort of 40 hours to reach Russia. But there's talk of arms as Putin's war in Ukraine obviously grinds to a halt with the rumors there of munition shortages. So yeah, it begs the question, has he gone and done a deal for some of those old Russian compatible weapons that he sold Kim Jong-un many, many years ago?
Answer on a postcard, but I think the answer is probably yes. You know, the reality is, help me out here, and Kim Jong-un's no friend of the West.
So what does that say for the security of other nations, like, you know, countries like Japan, South Korea, even the US, now that they're looking, we've got this genocidal maniac of Putin, and then you've got Kim Jong-un, who kind of like Trump had quite a good relationship with him, and now you've got him siding and visiting Putin. I mean, the Japanese and the Koreans must be looking on thinking, in fear, right? You know, if he's selling them, we don't know whether he's providing them with nuclear submarines or warheads and things like that. Because, you know, he basically Kim Jong-un has tested long-range ballistic missiles that could actually hit the UK.
Yeah, scary. Scary. I mean, the world is in a scary place, of this there is no doubt. But will we go to sort of these places and never return? I don't think so, personally. But
do you think that the world is on a higher state of alert now, or threat, than it was during the Cuban missile, you know, during the Cold War and the Cuban missile crisis?
Don't know. I was too young for the Cuban missile crisis, but the Cuban missile crisis was a bit of a if you don't do this, we're going to blow you up sort of thing. Whereas we're not at that stage, really, are we? Everybody's posturing. The West are sending military help to Ukraine to try and stop the Russians, but ultimately I don't think the West are able to send enough, and the Ukrainians don't have enough manpower to actually make this all happen. So it's a bit of a stalemate, and I think it will continue to be a stalemate until we get around the table and talk, you know, because it's a pseudo West versus East war. It's as simple as that, isn't it? You know, so, but it's being fought in the battlefield of Ukraine. So
yeah.
I think the sentiment here in the US is why are we spending huge amounts of money on sending weapons to Ukraine?
Yeah, on a proxy war, basically.
On a proxy war, and the US are, like, you know, the economy here is not good. Everything is expensive. The food is incredibly expensive.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about restaurants. I'm talking about the shops, you know. Bread, a loaf of bread here costs you $5 if you want a decent one, $5-6.
Yeah.
So how much is that? £3.50, £4 for a loaf of bread? Well, you're not paying that in the UK, I'm sure.
Well, we just went down into Winchester to, I know it's a local bakery, and you know, for sourdough, it's $5.25 for a sourdough down there now.
Okay, so maybe you are then, but maybe I'm just comparing to Egypt, because there's no way we pay anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, for a loaf of sliced bread, I'm paying maybe $1.
Yeah.
Whereas these prices are ultimately crazy. I can't believe it. But anyway.
So in other news, I mean, this is really causing a stir over here. I mean, and rightly so. I mean, I'm not sure what the answer is, and it'd be good to get your take on it. Basically, a man named Ian Price has unfortunately died from multiple injuries sustained in an attack by two suspected American bully XL dogs in Stonehall near Warsaw, Staffordshire. The 52-year-old victim was taken to Birmingham's Queen Elizabeth, but later was confirmed dead. A 30-year-old man from Lichfield was arrested on suspicion of manslaughter and initially on suspicion of being in charge of dangerously out-of-control dogs causing injury. So Rishi Sunak has pledged to ban this breed of American XL bully dogs, calling them a danger to communities. One of the dogs involved in the attack was restrained, while the other died after an injection given by a vet. A recent dog attack in Birmingham had already sparked a debate about banning specific dog breeds, although some argue that irresponsible breeding, rearing and ownership are more significant issues. You've got a lot of people saying banning a specific dog like this breed will not stop the attacks. It's just saying it sadly will not stop them. It's all about basically responsible. You know, you need to get to the bottom, tackle the root issue by dealing with the unscrupulous breeders who are putting profit before welfare, and the irresponsible owners whose dogs are dangerously out of control. I mean, I know you've got a couple of dogs, we've got dogs, but what are your thoughts? I mean, is it the breed that is the problem, or is it the owners that are the problem?
Yeah, it's the breed. It's called the human race. They're basically, you've got, in most cases, the people who own those dogs are what type of people? They're trying to show something through the superiority or power of their dog, right? And this is bad for us all.
Yeah.
You know, so I have no issues with banning, you know, those breeds because they've been bred to be lethal. So is it any different than gun law? You know, would they let somebody have walk around the park with a gun? No. Would you let someone walk around with a dog? And if this dog gets off, it's probably going to kill another dog at least. If it doesn't kill another dog, then it might kill a child or attack another man. So, you know, why should we have these dogs? We've never had the dogs before.
Yeah.
You know, so.
So you agree that it is an ownership issue, but it's also is potentially some of these bigger dogs, the lethal breeds that are bred normally for fighting, like the pit bull type dogs, should be banned.
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, yes. Mm. I mean, what is the purpose of those dogs other than to fight?
Bred for fighting, yeah.
There isn't another reason. I mean, you could argue all the way down then to something like a German Shepherd dog, but a German Shepherd dog is a shepherd dog. It's not meant to be a fighting dog. It isn't a fighting dog.
Yeah.
It is a dog that shepherds things. So, you know, I think we've always had that type of dog and it's never really caused a big problem. But these other dogs are bred exclusively to be aggressive. I mean, you see how muscular they are. You can't stop them.
Well, there's one here in photo, and there's a woman who's written into the BBC saying, Charlotte, saying that Coco is the best behaved dog she's owned. She's got one that's 60 kilograms in weight. And, you know, that's a quite a heft. You know, she's 60 kilograms of love, she's saying. She's saying, I just don't think you should judge a book by its cover before you decide to make the ban. Perhaps come and meet other dogs like Coco that are getting the bad name. And they really don't deserve it.
Yeah, there's going to be responsible owners. There's going to be dogs that are good. But the problem is that that's not everybody, is it?
Yeah, no.
And if you put that type of lethal animal in with other people, then it becomes a lethal weapon.
Yeah.
And if the other there is dogs in, and that doesn't happen.
No, I think you're right. There is this kind of like you see in inner cities and suburbia, you see a lot of these youngsters walking around with them on chains as a symbol, status symbol almost, or a symbol of, like, you know what I mean? It's a superiority thing, as you say. It's quite aggressive, isn't it, when you see it? And it's intimidating, right? You imagine walking two of those on a lead and they're pulling away. It's quite intimidating, right?
Well, walking you, not the other way around.
Yeah. They've already been banned in other countries as well. So they're illegal in Turkey and the UAE. And they're also restricted in some countries. I think Republic of Ireland, where any American bully must be muzzled and on a leash no longer than 2 meters when out in public. So that, you know, even if they're not banned, they're aware that they should be muzzled and leashed.
Yeah. Why should we settle this on that? Is all I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that brings us on to our first guest this week. You may know him from some TR1 RNSs or from a listed junior explorer. We welcome Aidan O'Hara, professional investor and corporate development director of Fulcrum Metals. Welcome, Aidan. How are you?
Great, Phil. Thanks a million for having me on. And great to see you guys. Great to see you, Kevin, as well.
Very good. So, I mean, obviously, as I alluded to just then, you know, some people may know you from certain Telegram groups, certain shares that they've been invested in, where they've probably seen your name appearing on a significant holdings RNS. But you want to just tell us a bit about you and your background and what it is that you actually enjoy in life, Aidan?
Yeah, sure. I'm a lover of running, so a very early riser. And I usually get up about half five, and I usually go out for a run 4 to 5 times a week, you know. I use my running to get my creative ideas and my business ideas. So by the time, you know, I get back in, people are only starting to turn over. That would really be my love in life. But my other love in life is business. And when I was 18 and I left school, you know, I just wanted to have my own business. No interest in going to university. So I started working for a couple of guys who had a retail business. And after about 2 years, I opened my own store. But ironically, they were actually into the stock market and they kind of got me into it because I just had a big love for them and they were great guys. Yeah. So I just got into the stock market and started trading I bought my first stock with my dad about 30 years ago, a company called Emerald Energy. Used to watch it on CFAX. I don't know if you guys
I remember those days. My granddad was a big investor. And I always remember him at the beginning of the day, then in the lunchtime, and then at the end of the day, key in, was it like 179, the finance section, and bang, you'd get, and he'd be waiting for ages for like 7 of 9 pages to roll round.
Yeah.
Then you're like, oh my God, I missed it. What was it? Hold, and you try and get the whole book.
Exactly. But that was myself and my dad, you know, we'd sit down kind of like, and we'd go through CFAX and eventually your stock would come up. But like at that stage, I hadn't got a clue about the market, you know. I just had the stock and I was, you know, I was told to buy it basically, and I bought it and it did really well. And I remember myself and my dad, like I had my shares and my dad had his shares. And when we looked at it at the end of the day, I think between the two of us, we might have had about 7,000 pounds sterling. Now that was actually quite a lot back in that day, you know, but we kind of didn't really understand the value of money either. So, but anyway, we went off and I actually bought my first house with it. So that's what I did. I put it into property. Obviously it was in Dublin and the whole property cycle went crazy. And that year I actually bought three houses. It was just one of those things. Got on well with the bank manager. He liked me. He said, you know, this guy knows what he's doing. He's kind of fairly, you know, clued in. And that's what happened. I built up a very large property portfolio. But getting back to the shares, so I started to understand the markets. I started to understand, you know, when I was losing money in the stock market, oh my God, there's actually two elements here. There's stock market listing and there's the company. Started to realize that a lot of guys who were CEOs of companies that just fell into that, you know, job, they actually, they understood maybe the company, but they didn't understand the market. And I think today it's very important for investors to understand that you need to, the guys that are running the company need to understand how to run their business, but they also need to understand the market. And unfortunately, the market takes up a lot of time for a CEO. So it is a very hard job. And it's certainly a job I wouldn't like to be doing. It's so my job as corporate development director in Fulcrum Metals, it's more of a job that I feel comfortable with because I'm on the outside of the company and I'm looking in. Yeah, so that's really kind of how we got into Fulcrum.
Yeah, let's go back a minute. So let's talk about your recent successes, because obviously, you know, that was a hell of a win you got from that 7,000 there to be able to get on the property ladder. But talk us about some recent, because obviously we've seen your name on things like Prospects. But what about, when did it start of recent times? Because obviously the market hasn't been as buoyant as sort of the last 2 years. But what happened in what we call the COVID casino times around March 2020? Can you tell us a little bit about what some of your successes back then?
Yeah, sure. So I had actually stopped looking at the market for about 2 years back in 2018. Every now and then I peek in and I like to do a bit of technical trading. So I'd look at my charts, and then COVID hit and I noticed that some of the stocks had started to go nuts and liquidity came into the market. So I had a few quid and I invested into Alien Metals UFO. And I think I started investing in it at 0.06p and it went all the way to 3.07, as far as I can remember. I met another guy who was doing exactly the same thing and I got him to load up on UFO. We started investing together, along with Ryan actually. And then we got that money and we put it into Echo Energy. So we moved on, we did Zephyr, and then we had a few quid, we put it into Prospects. Started buying Prospects about 1.5 million cap and kind of felt like there needed to be a bit of a change in the management. That came about and it went all the way to, I think it went to close to 50 million cap at one point. I think at one stage I might have had about 11.5% of the company. So it was just great, you know. It was great for your ego. It was great for, you know, people saw then that I understood the market and that I was able to make money. That's really a key thing, isn't it? You know, when you're a director of a company, you need to know how to make money.
It is, yeah. Talk us through what you look for in, you know, when you make these large investments, you build a position in the company. You know, you must be looking at the things like that, you know, look at the company's finances, the balance sheets, potentially the CEO and the board of directors. But just talk us through how you start that process.
Yeah, it's funny because I wouldn't heavily home in on the financials of the company straight away. You know, I'd always look at a chart and I'd look at technical of a company, but because I'm trading so long, you know, or I'm in the market for over 30 years, I know a lot of these companies. So I know a lot of the history. So I've known where they've been and I know the pitfalls of them. So that kind of helps me, you know. So for example, if I'm looking at a company and I go, do you know what, I think it might be a good time to buy into that. I'll always kind of buy a little bit of stock. And then you do a bit more research, you might look at the technicals, you might look at the, you know, the CEO, the skin in the game, and you look at the board, obviously, and then you look at the shares and issue, and obviously the assets. And usually from that, based on exactly, no, and I'd also be looking at my entry point. So if everything in that respect is right, then I would probably put a good few quid in. And you know, I kind of stick, like if I'm into a company, I'll load up on it. So I don't do it that often. I'm not a trader. I like to hold, you know, my stock from anything from 6 months to 2 years. That's kind of usually roughly in around the time, you know, line for my investing. But obviously with Fulcrum, nobody has to worry about me selling out on that because I'm part of the board. I'm a founder of the company and I'm in it for, you know, I mean, we set up Fulcrum, and when we set it up, you know, we also had an exit strategy in mind. So that's a 5 to 7 year play for anyone who's interested in taking a look at it.
So Aidan, interesting. You've made money in some stocks. Have you also had loaded up on some things and it's been a disaster, or have you had success all along?
No, I've had a few poor runs, you know, and I think I'm more selective today on how I invest in companies. So I've never really blown out. Like, I've always been good at, you know, I'm a good strategy that if I feel that it's going south, I just get out and I take the loss. I'm very happy to take the loss because there's always, you know, there's always something else to put your money into. So I don't mind taking a hit, you know, and you can use a hit as a tax loss as well. So it kind of balances out sometimes.
Yeah, it's a good learning experience, I think, for all investors to understand that a loss is not necessarily a bad thing, especially when the loss could get bigger. I think this is something that people sort of hold on. You know, I thought at the beginning this was going to do well and I'm still going to stick to my guns and whatever. When everything's screaming that actually this has changed from when I first invested, you know.
There's a saying, a long-term investment is a short-term investment got her on. I always have that in the back of my head, you know. But when it comes, obviously, to investing, it's different, you know. And what's really interesting as well about picking a stock is I like to pick trends. You know, I don't like to just buy a stock because, that looks good, or, you know, there's some good videos there about it. Or I like to pick a stock that's trending. So, like, for example, you know, people are talking about, the analysts are talking about the oil market, and it's going to, you know, the oil price was obviously very low from COVID, and then it's going to move up. Well, then I'm going to look at buying into stocks. And like I did that with Zephyr. You know, I bought into Zephyr at half a penny, went to 8p fairly quickly as well, you know, less than a year. So I like trends, and that's why, you know, myself and Ryan started buying stock and started buying ground out in Canada, because we believe, you know, with the whole battery mineral cycle and, you know, gold and the issues in the US with you know, world debt, that gold is going to go on the run. And that's why we, you know, that's why we got into Fulcrum and why we started buying ground, and because of the trend. And obviously that's, you know, we're planning on gold being the next trend, and obviously uranium as well, which seems to be setting itself up quite nicely for a very strong run.
Yeah, I mean, my call has always been in the last few years anyway, that the US dollar is primed to plummet at some point because it's just not backed by anything and they just keep printing it. So the reserve currency is going to be what? Who knows? But gold has to play a role in this somewhere down the line. And just like it did 50 years ago before in Bretton Woods, they decided, alas, we will not do this anymore. We will not have fractional gold underneath our currencies. But just like Bitcoin has come in and basically said, there's only so many of these. We need to have our fiat currencies again, somehow backed by something.
Maybe a gold dollar from the BRICS and bring back the gold standard. Yeah, I think it's manipulated. And I do believe, you know, strongly that we will see it moving in the future, for sure. You know, I wouldn't be surprised in the next 5 years if we saw gold in around $3,500. People think that's a bit, you know, it's a bit rich. But if you factor in inflation going back from the 1920s all the way today, I think gold actually comes in around $10,000. So my figure of $3,500 based on the inflation, you know, mathematical equation is actually kind of conservative.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, it costs more money to get the gold out the ground these days than it did before. So you're going to have an increased value no matter what. And I think that is for sure. So tell people who don't know, what is the background of Fulcrum Metals? How did it happen? And yeah, the story so far.
Yeah, so myself and Ryan set up a company in 2018 called Four Consult Group. We went to the States and we were looking for We were just looking for projects. You know, we started off looking for projects and we met up with some guys in the oil industry and, you know, we actually got on very well with them. And that's another thing where myself and Ryan are very good at networking with people. We kind of believe that, you know, success is based around, you know, being personable and networking. And, you know, there has to be trust and loyalty with people. So we've been growing that since 2018, you know. So kind of in a way, Fulcrum Metals kind of had started back in 2018. But it wasn't set up till, you know, maybe 3 years ago. So we were in the States. We were working with a really good group, very, very successful group, the Reynolds family. And we just realized that Canada was the place for us. We just started buying up ground. We didn't know exactly what we were going to get into at the time, but we just started buying up ground. And we had a really good, I had a really good connection with an Irish geologist called Ed Slowey, based just outside Dublin. And he decided to come onto the board and, you know, look at the projects with us. So we had a very good guy with us when we started to pick out our projects. I think we've done well with Fulcrum. I think we've got some very good projects. That's kind of how we started, really. It just kind of molded from there. And then we found a broker, we found a nomad, and we found people who were interested in investing into us. We did a seed round, and we did a pre-IPO, and then we did the IPO with Clear Capital. We raised 2.9 million, and the board put 100k in. So we raised 3 in total.
So where are you now? When did you IPO?
We IPO'd on Valentine's Day.
I'm going to say February the 14th, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You're never going to forget that one, are you, Aidan?
It was such a lovely day to IPO. And I remember when we were doing some of the interviews, you know, at Clear Capital, looking to get investors in the IPO. And we told the guys, you know, we were going to Fulcrum. We wanted it to be different. We didn't want to be that, you know, junior explorer that's sitting on properties and you're, you know, you're doing your work and you're drilling and you're raising your money every year and you're sitting on the same properties. We want to be kind of, a different type of vehicle to that. And we want to move on our properties, get value in them and bring in bigger properties. So we said we'd bring in, a property with a resource. We just brought in Tully there a few months ago with 107K ounces. Good, very good grade gold between 5 and 6 grams a ton, you know. And so that's our first move in the market. We did a CLN at 18.5p. And at the time, the stock was 14.7 to 15. And the board put in 190k. So, I mean, I think that sent out a very, very strong message to the market that we're very confident in building this company. And, I know what I can do and Ryan knows what he can do. And we've got a really, really strong board. We've got a very strong network of people that we've built up around us that we're going to start using as we move forward and we build the value of the company. So we're very excited. Very excited about Fulcrum.
Yeah. So in this job report that you've got, then what is happening at that particular property then? Are we just sitting with the job report or are you going to actually mine that or... You're hoping to sell that?
I think we can, there are some areas that were drilled that were never included in the resource. So I think at some stage we'd like to go back there and drill. It's a winter project. So, you know, there's a small window in Canada and then you've got the snow. So this project fits in really well because we want to have news flow, you know, right across the year. So with a winter project, you've got to be bringing out news in the winter time. You've got to be working on that project and that'll cover the whole year for us. Then we've got Big Bear, obviously. We want to drill as well. And we're very excited about Big Bear and some new targets. And, you know, on Big Bear, we've got a really interesting gold trend, about 3 kilometers long. And, you know, it's open. And I think we can extend it quite considerably. So I think we're sitting in a very good position. I think we're, you know, where the stock is at the moment, 15.5p. In my opinion, it's a really good buy-in. The board are tied in at 29.9, so it's very hard for us to be buying in the market at the moment. But, you know, I'm very keen to support, you know, the company I founded. And I think liquidity-wise, it's been pretty quiet for us. But I think people are still getting to know the company and still need to figure out, you know, what exactly we're trying to do here.
So how do you find it, Aidan, then, on the other side of the fence? Because you have been... the investor, the one who's talking to the CEO and obviously whoever else is involved in the company. And now you're on the other side of the fence. So how are you finding it?
I think it's incredible. I think it's very exciting. And I'm incredibly bullish about Fulcrum. Like I have two other businesses here in Dublin that I've had, like I set up my retail company when I was 20. I still have that business, but I don't run it. Someone else runs it. I have a property business here in Dublin, and we have specialized accommodation services with the government. And I don't run that business anymore. I stopped running that about a year ago to totally focus on Fulcrum. And all my energy, my power, my thought is with Fulcrum. Myself and Ryan are 24/7 Fulcrum. And, it's just great to be on the other side. Like, it's not like a job, it's a passion. We're totally passionate about building this company. We're very excited. And we know what to do. We understand how the market works. I mean, and this is an essential part of building Fulcrum, understanding the market and building the company for your shareholders, because it's their company. We don't think about ourselves when we're building Fulcrum. We think about our shareholders. We don't need to think about ourselves. It all comes together, and we have an exit strategy. So that's key to any investment, that you invest in. You need to know what the exit strategy is for the company, especially if you want to be a long-term shareholder.
But Aidan, as a significant shareholder in the company yourself, I think you're around about the 14%, and then with Ryan around a similar amount, and I think Panther have got a significant holding as well. What is that exit strategy? I mean, because obviously you see a lot of directors and board members who can never really sell the shares because many reasons, different periods, closed periods. So what is your exit strategy exactly for Fulcrum?
Well, I'll try and explain it this way. I spent a lot of time in property, and, if you get into property and you buy a couple of houses and you make a few quid, then all of a sudden you want to start building, you want to buy a bit of land and you want to get it in, get it on the ground. And, you might build a house, you might build two houses, you sell them all, you get the money in, and then all of a sudden, you want to, God, maybe I'll build five houses, maybe I'll build 10 houses. And you just keep on building up the value of your portfolio. You sell on, or you rent out, so you get money coming in. And that's kind of how Fulcrum is set up. And that's our psychology behind Fulcrum. We want to get value on our properties, and we want to, we want to either develop them out and bring in revenue, or we want to sell them on, get the money from them, and bring in bigger properties. Always bringing in more advanced, properties. We're very fond of gold. We believe gold is going to run, as I said earlier on. So we're looking at gold properties. What I'd like, this is me personally, not speaking for anyone else on the board, but I'd like us, before gold moves off, I'd like us to have at least a million and a half ounces of gold, in several projects where we can increase the amount of gold in those projects. Now, we'd be looking at high grade as well, high grade projects, where eventually at some stage, when we get to that arc of the bull cycle between 5 and 7 years, that we can just, if someone makes an offer for the company, that's our strategy. And we're working on that since day one, since we set up Fulcrum, because we're building a network of very successful people around us. And we're very fortunate to actually have met some really brilliant people and brilliant families over, since we set up Fulcrum Consult Group.
Very good. No, it's a very interesting concept. And I think one that, you are basically gambling on the price of gold, but also gambling on the fact that you can add value to the properties that you get, which I'm sure the add value to the properties you get is more probable or more possible in your own hands. The gold bull run, if you like, which I also agree with you that I think it's going to happen, is an imponderable, because we've been thinking this is going to be happening for many years now. But the stars seem to be aligning that this is going to happen purely because of the uncertainty in the world. Would you rather have a gold coin, or would you rather have right now, would you rather have a gold coin or someone give you $1,900? What would you rather have?
Well, I think gold isn't going anywhere. People love gold. They just love it, And I know we have crypto, but I just don't think it's the same thing. I think later on down the line, maybe in 20, 30 years, crypto will become more, will become more of a solid investment. But at the moment, it's very unstable and it's very erratic. But gold is just something special. I really believe in it. And yeah, you got to believe in it. You got to believe in what you're doing. You have to be 100% believing. I believe in Fulcrum. I believe in gold. I believe in our board. I believe in the trend, And yeah, it's very exciting. Very exciting times for us.
Yeah, there's lots of reasons why we should. Gold, Indian people want gold. It's their main store of wealth. The Chinese also are similar. And with such instability in the fiat currencies going forward, there is going to be more and more people using gold, I'm sure of it. Yeah. Will that translate to a higher price? It should, just purely on inflation, on the fiat currency. This without doubt, but time will tell. And yeah, I see you as a great bet for that process, basically. I mean, you are going to be supercharged by owning the assets, and also if the gold price goes up, that your share price could skyrocket, basically, if those factors come into play.
Yeah, and you know, I've betted on things before, like I've betted on the property market when I was in my 20s, you know. I betted on oil, I betted on gold, silver before, and I've done well. And I just believe if you bet on something that's going into trend, you know, as they say, all boats rise. I think with Fulcrum, you know, I think we've got some really, like, our solid base, as in our seed investors, and that they're very, very solid. And we've got some very interesting high net worth individuals behind us, helping us and investing in Fulcrum. So I'm very confident that we're at a very, very solid level. And I don't think it would take much buying to move the share price significantly.
Good. I look forward to speaking to you again anyway, when we can talk about the actual products and talk about the nitty-gritty of Fulcrum, so people can understand the stages that all your projects are at, and also maybe other projects that you're trying to bring on board, because I think that will give people a great overview of what's happening.
Yeah, no, I'd be absolutely delighted to chat with you guys again.
Just one last question before we go. I always ask guests this. What's the best advice you've ever received?
I think the best advice I've ever received is to believe in yourself. Yeah, believe in yourself and believe the people that you're with, believe the people that you're connected to. And, you know, you need to have a trust and a loyalty with people. It's like a marriage. Like, if there's no trust in a marriage, not going anywhere. So yeah, trust, loyalty, and belief.
Excellent. Well, that was a sort of new thing, wasn't it? To have an investor on, a professional investor, to hear of successes. And obviously, I think it was quite right of you to ask, have you actually suffered any losses? Because quite a lot, it's almost like asking a gambler, you know, if they've had any losses. A lot of them deny them, don't they? They only really hear of gamblers' winnings. That's all they ever talk about, isn't it? But actually, in reality, they're probably getting a lot more losses than they are wins. That's the part of the process, isn't it? It's like, why do casinos exist? The casino wouldn't exist if the house didn't have the upper hand and was always winning. But ultimately, yeah, it was very interesting to hear his successes, and also what kind of got him into that industry and into Fulcrum Metals, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, even at off recording, I mean, he didn't really want to talk about numbers, but I mean, he really did turn a minimal amount of money. I think it was something like 20,000 euros or less to 4 million pounds inside 2 or 3 years, because he just had multi-bag after multi-bag after multi-bag after multi-bag, and he just rolled them all into the thing. So yeah, I mean, he has been a major success in terms of that. My view was that, you know, the next thing that he's going after is the gold and obviously hybrid gold opportunities that exist there in Canada. So I think it's a very interesting proposition, or one to keep the eye on, I think, you know, because
yeah,
I think in terms of value, it's certainly not overvalued and probably undervalued, in terms of the fact that I think he said that the management weren't really in the money until 29 or 30 pence, you know, and it's currently 15p. And I mean, the other interesting thing that I looked at after we did the interview was that there was only, I think it was only
49 million, isn't there, in outstanding. And as I say, Panther Metals owns about 15%. Ryan and Aiden own like 28% between them, just under 29, just sort of around that under 30% magical figure. So really half of the stock is in sticky hands. And he was saying that there's a lot of other TR1 and other holders. So there's probably only 30 to 40% of that stock in free flow. And there's not many, as you say, there's not many million shares out there, is there?
Yeah, so if you work that out, and let's say there's 35% or a third roughly in free hands at 48 million, at 16 million shares at 15p, that's less than £2 million.
Yeah, any buyers,
is it? No, sorry. It's about £2.5 million. So £2.5 million is the free float of what's being, you know, bought and sold. And, you know, some of that's going to be in sticky hands as well. So it's like, yeah, it could be an interesting one as news comes forth in terms of what they're doing, you know.
Yeah. Let's have a look at the stocks of the week. We've had Barkby, which is they'll just sort in by the 5 days. Barkby, top riser of the week. Bark is the ticker. Market cap 10 million. The, we're exploring options to maximize shareholder value from the subsidiary Cambridge Sleep Sciences, including potentially selling or spinning off the business. Bartby has appointed advisors to review its investment in CSS, given the commercial potential of Sleep Engine, and as Bartby focuses on its roadside real estate strategy. So that's been the mover of the week. It's up about 150%, so it's done very well. What else have we got on there? We've had Ben's Creek had an announcement this week, in the basically stating that they'd resumed full production after a period of reduced output due to damage to Highwall Mine 81. Caused by that mining incident, which we referred to, I think, in an earlier interview with Adam. Both Highwall miners are now fully operational, and a second shift has been introduced for both. So what do you make of that? I mean, it reacted relatively well in the morning, didn't it? I think it moved a good sort of 8%. But and we've also seen an increase recently in high vol A and high vol B prices, right?
Yeah, I mean, based on the previous sort of share price, it was almost sort of price to fail. At, I think around the 12, 13p mark, wasn't it? Or even maybe slightly lower than that. And to consider it launched at 10p a year and a half ago now is a bit bizarre considering where it still sits at 16p. Yeah, I mean, it's going to be producing, what, 18,000 tons a month, something like that, clean coal, with the two shifts and the underground, which has increased. But I think it's always been, and Adam has always stated that, effectively, this was a call option to the price of met coal. And met coal dipped to 180-something, I think it was, per ton. And I think Ben's Creek was probably, you know, at full production at 180, they might be making some money, but not a huge amount.
Yeah.
But now, a week or two later, they're for sure making $30, $40 minimum per ton. So you work that out on a million tons and you're making $40 million a year. Now, every increase that goes on from here, assuming it does go up, which is being signaled by the market and the futures, then it just becomes, you know, every dollar is going to be $1 million more, $1 million
more, $1 million. Well, high vol A was up to 260 and high vol B up to 220, as you alluded to. So there is been a real movement. It's been a huge jump in the index over the last few days.
Yeah. And it's predicted that that's going to continue, and they're talking 250, 260 for Ivor B, I think, over the next few weeks. So, again, if that happens, then all of a sudden Ben's Creek is in a situation where, you know, it's considerably more valuable as a company than it was 6 weeks ago. So, I suppose this is the variances of the market, isn't it, and so in terms of those things, but they have a lot of resource. The resource is also being increased as we discuss things. So, yeah, I can't see that it's going to stay at this low level for much longer, to be honest. The other one that had a good set of results this week was Aterian. Reported positive results in Morocco, including samples containing 2.3% copper, which is excellent on its own, but then you add 33 grams per ton of silver on top of that as well. It's an incredibly good result. The Zahia project spans 96 square kilometers, and it's situated 70 kilometers from Rabat and 80 kilometers east of Casablanca. And this is only one of 17 copper silver things that they've got in Morocco, so at over nearly 900 square kilometers. So yeah, I think this, along with what they've happened in Rwanda, is basically setting Aterian up to be a very good investment, I think, going forward. And along with the fact that I keep putting it on people that Aterian is not just trying to be the explorer and find this stuff, it's also going to be a dealer, if you like, of the things that, especially in Rwanda. So there should be income being produced over the next few months, even from the stuff that's happening in Rwanda. And the big miner that they did business with.
Yeah, I mean, Rio Tinto. I mean, do you think the market has completely missed the fact that they've got a lithium joint venture with Rio Tinto, the sort of second largest mining company in the world? That's the bit that doesn't quite compute.
Yes, is the simple answer. Whether the market's missed it or just the market's not reacting to pretty much anything at the minute, I don't know, but yeah, the market's missed it, because there's no way Rio Tinto are going into that with the eyes shut and don't think they're going to, you know, try and make things happen, because I'm sure they are. But the interesting thing was that I think Rio Tinto has helped them a great deal as well in terms of the trading company, because it's given them credibility within Rwanda and also given them credibility with bigger players. Yeah. So I'm expecting some good things to come of that as well, you know. And another one really that had some news, nothing spectacular in terms of news, but some more news, was Conroy Gold, another one that people just don't seem to want to connect with value for some reason.
I mean, be careful. It had £46 worth of trade on the back of this RNS.
No, just unbelievable. Unbelievable. You know, activities at Drumbaddy on its Fleet Cloud gold target in County Cavan. The exploration work being carried out by Demir Export revealed a new gold in bedrock target at the southwestern end of the 65-kilometre Orlock Bridge. So that means the gold trend possibly goes much further as well. Notable finds included 10-metre gold in bedrock zone encountered in central. So basically they found a big rock, 10 metres long, and they can see the gold, which they subsequently confirmed by drilling. Another drill hole intersected a separate gold zone with 2 grams per ton gold over 1 meter. These results validate the prospectivity of the Sleepglar target area, making a significant development in the project. Everywhere they look, they're finding gold.
Yeah.
And yet nobody seems to be putting that into any value structure. So again, we will be going either the very end of October, first week in November, to Ireland, and anybody is invited if they wish to come and check out what's happening with Conroy Gold. And we're about to sort out the situation with the company. Obviously, you'll be paying your own way to Dublin and accommodation, but the company, I think, will be guiding us to show us the projects and also have some sort of presentation and dinner, I think.
Yeah, I reached out to Maureen, actually, a couple of days ago, just to sort of, to obviously see, talk about doing a podcast. And Professor's away at the moment, and I'd since said, realised it's actually his birthday, so I wished him a happy birthday. I believe many congratulations are in order. It's his 90th birthday, Kev, can you believe? I mean, how good does he... I mean, we met him last year, and we've shown around all the, you know, not all of them, but obviously went to the assets there. And he was great gentleman, wasn't he? Really nice guy. Yeah. Cannot believe how mobile he is and how switched on he is.
Yeah, no, he's switched on for sure. And he wants to see the value come from this, of this, I have no doubt. So, yeah, he's got a few more years in him left, I'm sure. But, yeah, so that offer's going to be open. We'll put something in writing in some of the groups, I think. So if people want to partake of that, you're more than welcome.
Very good.
So what else has been going on?
Well, there's been another mover that's been on the radar is Seed, our friend Ed McDermott from Seed Innovations. They moved from around low twos about a week and a half ago, maybe 2 weeks max. They were sat around the 2 pence mark. And then they had two RNSs, one last Friday and then one on Monday of this week. And basically, I think they've got a 7 million market cap. But before that, they were around about the kind of like 4.5, 5. They had sold 2,900 share units of Avextra AG. They're a German-based medical cannabis company for 2.9 million euros, which is circa 2.45 million pounds, which represented a 62% return on Seed's original investment. So well played, Ed. Seed will retain 3% of Avextra on a fully diluted basis following the sale of Seed's total cash position will be approximately £4.6 million, with further cash receivables from the sale of Leap Gaming of around £2.5 million. Seed's total cash and receivable position of £7.1 million is significantly higher than its current market cap of approximately £5.11. So obviously that was during when it was RNS, but it has since moved up to £7 million. So circa... The market cap is currently at cash as we speak now on the Friday. So what are your thoughts on that, on that sale and the position they're in now going forward?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the market cap, I think the NAV before the sale was probably around £8-9 million. So it was significantly undervalued. I mean, if you go back only 3 or 4 weeks, I think it was in the ones. It was like 1.5p, I think, or 1.6 or 1.7, but there was definitely value there, and a lot of that value is being closed now. I don't know where it goes from here, whether it got that much upside. I think this money has to be deployed now, and maybe this is going to be a very good time to deploy this cash. because the market's been obliterated basically in terms of some of the other stuff. So yeah, it could be an interesting play, but certainly not a short term up. I think a lot of the gain may have already been made here. Yes, it might go up a tiny bit more, but I don't see it like going to the moon, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. I mean, it did drop back, didn't it, a lot from, I mean, what used to be around the 5, 6, 7 pence mark, didn't it, for a member seed, all that, you know, 2 or 3 years ago. It sort of, that was 5p was kind of like that kind of lower end of the share.
Yeah. Well, we did see 12, 13, 14p when we thought Leap Gaming was going to be worth literally $50 million to $100 million. And I don't remember the name of the...
There was Portage as well, wasn't there, as well, which was in it as well.
Yeah, and some of that was sold down, but also the company that Ed was involved in as well.
Yeah, well, there's Northern Leaf as well, which is the cannabis producer, which that they had an update on that. They provided an update on two of the companies. The other one was OTO International, a wellness brand. So there's been some really good, you know, updates from them. And I did reach out to Ed and say, looking good. You know, it's nice to see actually some interest coming back. And he's going to come on a podcast over the next week or two. So look out for that one.
Good. No, I don't think it's a bad investment at all. And I think if Ed deploys this cash well again, then I think it could do really well in the next 1, 2, 3 years. How much further has got to go just now? Don't know. It would be dependent on what's involved.
Yeah. So there's another one on Friday, a good R&S, and it moved the stock about 15%. It was Greatland Gold. I don't know if you've heard of Greatland Gold. Bit of a joke, obviously one of the probably the biggest company on AIM right now. They applied for exploration licenses covering 126 square kilometres of land in Yennari within the Gascoyne region of Western Australia. The area was identified as having potential for precious and base metal deposits similar to Havieron and Telfer through a prospectivity study. The geological environment and history of the district are considered favourable for large-scale deposits. The Yennari project is located between the Yilgarn and Pilbara cratons with known mineral occurrences including gold, copper, uranium and manganese. Sean expressed the company's focus on identifying and securing prospective ground to leverage their experience and track record of success. So one that was a real hit with the market when that news came out on Friday. What are your thoughts on the news then? I mean, did you see that on Friday?
I did, yeah. I mean, a good strong result from it. And I mean, Greatland's got a lot of things going to happen in the next while. I mean, for where it will be in a year's time when it's producing gold, having revenue and all the rest, even though it has a market cap of £370 million,
yeah,
it's still relatively cheap in terms of what should come from what's going to happen in terms of the gold production. So, and it has an awful lot of exploratory upside as well, both in gold and the copper ahead of it. So, it's an interesting play.
So did you see the news on I think it was on the Thursday, the day before, where they talked about this additional $50 million Aus dollars in available funding through standby facility from their cornerstone investor, Wyloo Metals. That was announced sort of on the morning of the Thursday. Also, letter of support remaining in place for the original $220 million Aus dollars 7-year Havieron project finance agreed through those banks, you know, Australia, New Zealand Banking Group, ANZ and HSBC. So, yeah, it certainly looks like there's a lot of interest and there's a lot of people very much willing to lend out on this into this company.
Yeah, and they've got huge backing from that company. Obviously, the Wyloo Metals, richest man in Australia or whatever it is, I think.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, is it going to produce what it's going to produce? Yes, as far as I'm concerned, it is. And if it does, then purely on the gold that's in play, it has to be in the next period of time worth more than it currently is. Yeah. But how many stocks can we currently say this about? It is like beyond a joke almost. How many stocks we can point to and say that is materially undervalued for what it is?
Yeah,
it's just countless.
Absolutely.
So, in some ways, covering them ourselves is incredibly frustrating because it's like the true value of these stocks is not really being seen. I mean, the stock market is supposed to be a forward-looking mechanism. And it's not at the minute. It really just is not a forward-looking mechanism. It's a, we'll give you the result and now we'll decide what the valuation is now. Yeah. And then even then, it doesn't really hold the value very well. So
it's like no one believes, isn't it? It's almost like the price in doomsday or something like that into it.
But until we get a bit more liquidity back into the basis, then maybe things aren't going to change that quickly. But I tell you, the minute that liquidity starts dropping in, this market's going to go berserk, as far as I'm concerned. The small cap resources market is so undervalued. I mean, you quoted it last week, the guy who used to be the Power Metal Resources guy.
Paul Johnson, yeah.
What was his name? Paul Johnson, you know, that he thought it was going to be 2 or 3 times uplift on all of these stocks. And that wouldn't even give it fair value in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
So it's interesting times ahead.
What we're looking forward to then, obviously, a lot of them, as you say, coming to hopefully to some sort of sense of valuation. But things like stocks like TM1 that just sit there at a level, it'd be nice to get, hopefully we'll get something in through from the commissioning. I think the market's waiting massively with bated breath on that. Be good to get something. And obviously...
Well, with TM1, you've got three different factors. You've got the commissioning, and maybe four, actually. You've got the commissioning finishing or finalizing it to its full capacity, if you like. You've got first sales of black mass.
Yeah.
You've got first agreement of their stock, which then is going to bring them more cash. And then you've got the lead acid battery license. So you've got four things, any of which could fall at any moment, I think, that should happen over the next number of weeks. So there should be some really, really strong catalysts for Tang Minerals in my view.
You were a betting man. Would you put, I know you are a betting man, but would you like to say that, would you like to think that by the end of this year that they've got both plants in production?
Yes, I would bet a considerable amount that both would be in production. Yes.
Yeah, that's what I'm all.
I think, you know, this is such a trendy area, if you like. Trendy is the wrong word. On trend, I suppose, is the better way of putting it. On trend, you know, we're basically lithium and recycling all in the same, you know, scenario, that, you know, this is going to be taken on by some of the big boys in the long run, in my view. Yeah, it's going to need a lot more cash, going to need a lot more impetus, and that is something that will expand this business exponentially. And in my view, this is what's going to happen. Now, when that happens and what the time scale is for all of that, I don't know. And you've got basically the Tech Mineral and Recyclers coming together, has to happen as well. So there's a lot of ifs and buts, and I think that's one of the reasons why the share price is languishing where it is, to be honest, because there's many imponderables. But as a betting man, as you know, we have, you know, happy to declare it, I have a personal holding, and as a company, we have a long-term holding as well. So, you know, for us, and me especially, I think this is going to be a share for the next couple of years, and it's going to do, in my view, pretty damn well, especially from this low level, because it is low compared to what it should be valued at, in my view.
Okay, well, 100 finished at 77.11. I don't know what your thoughts on that. Obviously, there was a lot of bated breath this week related to the hike from the European Central Bank on Thursday, which I think they've softened interest rate expectations, which is obviously good news for homeowners and for people who are borrowing right now. But it's done FTSE 100 strong, right?
It's done over 10%, hasn't it, since its lows?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's moving on up. It's moving on up. And the problem with the FTSE, it seems to be like a boomerang, doesn't it? Like down to 7, back up to 7, high 7s, maybe 8, down to 7, back up again. Because that's the pattern it's been in now for quite a while. So it needs to break out of that one way or the other. And obviously we want it to be breaking out upside, and we'll see. Yeah, the other one that came out this week was the share option thing on for Chill, which was pretty encouraging, I think. You know, basically they were priced at 4p, 8p, 16p, 32p. So it sort of tells a story, doesn't it? If you've got a CEO share options going from basically where we are now to 32p, that's pretty encouraging in terms of where we think we're going to go. Yeah, I can't really say much more, but watch this space.
Good. All right, anything else before we sign off for the week?
No, I don't think so. I think it's again, you can tell me better, because I've been in America, so when the market's been open, I've sort of been asleep. But just literally asleep. But the scenario is, have we actually woken up yet? September back in a swing?
No, at all. I mean, there are some stocks moving, and it, as I say, seed, and there's a few that I could reel off, and we've obviously talked about the ones, Barkby, et cetera, and that have moved. But ultimately, no, we're not seeing that real kind of, and even the Telegram groups are quieter, and Twitter's quieter. I think people are still, I always say this, I don't think it starts getting going again until sort of very late September, early October anyway. People are still on the holidays and getting back in and getting everything in order. So let's hope that we get a strong Q4 finish to this year, because it's how we need it. We all need it, right?
Yeah, we need a Santa rally, don't we? We need a Santa rally, 200% rally in all the stocks, and we'd all be smiling at Christmas time. But let's see.
On that note, I'll say thanks very much for listening. And if you like what you heard, then please hit the subscribe and like icon, the bell icon at the top, so you get updates for any future episodes.
Indeed. Again, thank you for listening, and we'll speak to you soon.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.